entry. So many people are aware of what happens there. Jesus comes down from Bethany, makes his way towards the city. He tells his disciples, hey, go ahead, go get this ready for me. You're going to find this colt, this young donkey. Go find it, bring it back to me. Well, they brought it back. He gets on top of it, and he starts parading down through the city. There's this praise that follows up with it, this praise, Hosanna, glory to God in the highest, all these different things. It's, hey, here you go, praise Jesus. He's who we're looking for. Who's who we're expecting to come. And as he's getting down through, all these people throwing palm branches up, whatever it may be, they're shouting, they're excited, they're happy. Well, the Pharisees, they weren't too happy with it. He said, tell them to stop. And his response, if I tell them to stop, nature itself is going to start crying out because God deserves praise. And so it keeps going. As he moves closer, he crests over this one hill that's part of the Mount of Olives, and he sees the city of Jerusalem, and he starts weeping over it, saying, Jerusalem, you missed it. I'm here. Where are you? You missed it. And he's sad because he starts prophesying, you're going to be destroyed. What happens? Well, about 40 years later, 70 AD, Jerusalem gets sacked by Rome. Rome comes in, completely destroys the city because there was a rebellion. Jesus continues going down through the city. He goes into the city, goes to the temple. At the end of that day, he leaves. He heads back out of town. He heads back to the city of, or the little village of Bethany, which is still part of the Mount of Olives. It's kind of like a small little hillside right outside of the city of Jerusalem. So he heads back out to Bethany. He spends the night there. That's where we pick it up in Mark chapter 11. As we're there in Mark chapter 11, we're going to start looking at that Monday morning. What happens on Monday morning? And I entitled it this morning, Time to Clean. Because really, last week it's like, oh, the triumphal entry. That's a perfect title because that's what we're talking about. Monday, time to clean up. Spring cleaning, anyone start doing it yet? I tried doing some cleaning yesterday. I didn't get too far, and I was like, I'm tired. Time to clean up, not physically, not cleaning our houses, spiritually. Time to clean up. Time to get things right again. And we're in Mark chapter 11. We're going to be in verses 12 through 9. Monday is a pretty interesting day. There's two main things that go on this whole day. There's an interaction right there at the beginning, 12, 13, 14. There's a fig tree that Jesus gets involved with, and he uses it as an illustration. And then he moves farther down, and he starts getting into the temple. And we see a side of Jesus that we don't always see. Let's get going. Mark chapter 11, verses 12 through 19. The next day, as they were leaving Bethany, Jesus was hungry. Seeing in the distance a fig tree and leaf, he went to find out if it had any fruit. When he reached it, he found nothing but leaves, because it was not the season for figs. Then he said to the tree, "May no one ever eat fruit from you again." And his disciples heard him say that. On reaching Jerusalem, Jesus entered the temple courts and began driving out those who were buying and selling there. He overturned the tables and the money changers and the benches of those selling doves, and would not allow anyone to carry merchandise through the temple courts. And as he taught them, he said, "It is written, 'My house shall be called a house of prayer for all nations.' But you've made it a den of robbers." The chief priests and the teachers of the law heard this and began looking for a way to kill him, for they feared him because the whole crowd was amazed at his teaching. When evening came, Jesus and his disciples went out of the city. Before I get going, would you mind turning on these center lights? I don't know if it's my eyes. It just seems very dim and dark up here. Just go ahead and turn on the center. Thank you. So last week, we were in the book of Luke. Is that better? Can you still see that? Yeah. Bright yellow and black do well. Does wonders. Good. I can see too. I like this. I'm not blind anymore. So last week, we were in the book of Luke. We kind of got an idea, and I want to remind you today, the Gospels, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, they record the story of Jesus, different parts of the story of Jesus, from a different perspective. Luke went at it one way, John a different, Matthew a different, and Mark even a different way. Who they're writing to is even a different audience in general. So it's written largely to that Gentile audience in Rome. So Mark here specifically, I have a specific target audience when I want to reach out to. As I'm writing, as I'm explaining things, I want to keep that in mind. So John's writing specifically with that in mind. He seeks to furnish the grounds for a decision to follow and keep on following Christ. Hey, take a look at this. You got to follow this guy and keep on following him. It's pretty important to Mark right there. His writing is in such a way that it makes you feel like Jesus is talking directly to you, and he's even questioning you. It's a personal conversation. As you read it, it's like you're there. You're the audience. That's Mark's intent. I want you to get it. I want you to understand. He's talking directly to you. And then you see it, one third of the book, chapters 11 through 16, they're focused on that final week of Christ. So one third of this entire book is focused just on the last week, 7 days, however long it took, right here. So Mark looks and says, there's something pretty important here. I want you to get it. When someone writes so much stuff on one topic, it's pretty important to them, and it should be pretty important to us too. So Mark, he's introducing, saying, I got something important I want you to understand. I got something that I want you to be listening to. I have something that Jesus, as he's talking to you, read it as if he's talking to you. Read it as if you're right there with him. You're front and center right there as he's preaching, as he's teaching. The one thing from this passage that I came to find out is Jesus took worship very seriously. Jesus took worshiping him and God very seriously. This isn't something just flippant. As we'll see, first with the fig tree and then in the temple. So we step in, verses 12 through 14. There's that cleansing of the temple. So if worship is that important, he steps right in the cursing of the tree. I jumped ahead of myself, verses 12, 13, and 14. He curses that tree, cursing the fig tree right there. So it's Monday morning. Jesus is leaving the city of Bethany. Remember, like I said already, Bethany is on that Mount of Olives, that 3-4 tier, however many mountain range it is. It's a small village right on the Mount of Olives. It has a good view of the city of Jerusalem, kind of the valley down below it. So he's there. It's Monday morning. Great view of the landscape, and Jesus starts walking down. And right away, we get that idea. He's hungry. Says, Jesus is walking towards the city of Jerusalem, and he sees a fig tree, and he's hungry. What does that prove to us? Well, he's human. He's God, and yet he's human there. It's just a small indication. Hey, this isn't just a spirit, where some people would say, well, Jesus and the Christ, he was just a spirit. He's just an idea. Well, there's the man Jesus, and then the spirit that came down, and it's the Christ. No, the whole of Jesus is human. He's hungry. He wants some food. Does he want a whole meal? Does he want just a snack? I don't know. I'm assuming it's just a snack, because why? Hey, look, a fig tree. Let's go over to it. He starts making his way towards this fig tree, and as he gets closer, he starts inspecting it more. So there's a fig tree. He sees this fig tree, and it's standing by itself. It's kind of out away from all the rest. So he's thinking, well, it's a hardy fig tree. It's a hardy tree. Usually when they're clumped together, they're not as strong because they're all protecting each other. If it's by itself, it's stronger. Maybe that means it's an earlier. I'm hearing a bunch of words, but nothing's right. Bloom. Man, I hate when that happens. So he's expecting the fruit was already there. He said, maybe there's a chance. Because why? There's leaves on the tree. As he gets closer, he starts inspecting it. What does he find? There's leaves, but there's no fruit. The figs aren't there. What happened? Because they're blooming. He would expect it. Oh, about the time that the leaves are blooming, the figs were there too. They're producing figs. But then it says there in the verse, it wasn't the time, it wasn't the season. Well, maybe he knew going into it, there's no figs on the tree. And then it transitions really quick. It turns and it says he curses the fig tree. That idea there, it's, may no one ever eat from you again. Right there in verse 14. He sees it. There's no figs. May no one ever eat from you again. Why is he doing this? What is his point there? Why did he just get so mad that there's no fruit on the tree? Maybe he's using it as an example, as an illustration. To who? His disciples. He and his disciples, they're coming down through. They see Jerusalem. There's no fruit. Fine, I'm going to curse you. No one's ever going to eat from you again. This actually comes back to play on Tuesday morning, the following day. But let's not get ahead of ourselves. He curses it. The disciples hear it. They hear exactly what he's talking about. The illustration is this. You look good on the outside. You look like you should have fruit. But when you get up close, when you actually see past the leaves, there's no fruit. Israel, you look good on the outside, but when you get up close, there's no fruit. That hypocrisy. I look good, but there's really nothing there. Israel, you know it. Israel, you have it. You have all the laws. You have all the teachers. Yeah, you can look good on the outside, but that doesn't mean anything to him. He's combating that idea of saying this hypocrisy is okay. Acting like one thing is okay, but really not being that. That's what he's trying to get rid of. That's what he's trying to get past. May no one ever eat fruit from you again. And his disciples heard him say it. He has an issue with the outward profession of faith without the fruit to back it up. That misrepresentation of yourself. Hey, look, I'm a believer. I follow Christ. Cool, where are your fruit? Where's your fruit to show it? Where's that fruit to back up that claim that you have? Fine, may no one ever eat from you again. Knowing his disciples were in earshot, so he's kind of teaching them something right now. Get rid of the hypocrisy. Get rid of the falseness of your claims, because it really means nothing to me. I kind of thought, I bet you the disciples were a little confused by this. He just got mad, cursed the fig tree. What's the point? Maybe they asked him at some point, what did you mean by that? Why did you do this? What are you trying to do? And it's just that confusion. But when we understand, Israel, you look good on the outside, but you don't have the fruit to back it up, get rid of that hypocrisy, get rid of that false claims that you have, because that means nothing to me. That's not what I want. I want the fruit that comes with it. It's that object lesson about true spirituality. What it means to be truly spiritual. Not just, hey, I can look good on the outside, but when you really get down to it, you're missing it. You're missing the fruit that should go right there with it. So Jesus continues on. He curses the fig tree, and then he keeps on moving forward. As he's moving forward, he comes down to the city of Jerusalem itself. Mark chapter 11, verses 15 through 17 say this. On reaching Jerusalem, Jesus entered the temple courts and began driving out those who were buying and selling there, overturned the tables of the money changers and the benches of those selling doves, and would not allow anyone to carry merchandise through the temple courts. As he taught them, he said, "Is it not written, 'My house shall be called a house of prayer for all nations,' but you've made it a den of robbers?" He's now in the city, and he starts heading to the temple to worship, because that's what Jews were doing. During this time, people were flooding the city. They're going to worship. They're excited to worship. So Jesus, coming to the city, he starts heading down towards the temple. So I have a picture of the temple. Just to get an idea, if you can throw it up there, that's the temple court as a whole. Well, you see the building, you kind of, Solomon's porch over here, you have the Antonia Fortress, that comes later on in Paul's ministry. Then you have the temple in the middle right there. So you have the main building, that's the temple itself. That has the holy place and the holy of holies. Right in front of it, kind of surrounding it, you have a court that is specifically designed for Jewish males. If you were not a Jewish male, you couldn't get into that. They took that seriously. When you get into that spot, you better be serious about what you're doing. Well, right outside that court, still in the main centerpiece, there's the court of women. That was for Jewish women to go and worship. Well, as Jesus gets into the court, he's still one step outside of that yet. He hasn't even made it into that inner part. He's still out into the court of the Gentiles, that big area right there. That's specifically what we're talking about. This was designed for Gentile men and women who converted to Judaism to come and have a place to worship. They said, hey, we still need to do this because we are having these people convert. So let's make a court for them. Let's give them a space to worship. He doesn't even get past this outside court, and he's starting to get angry. He walks in, and he's just frustrated beyond belief. Now, let me take a second. This isn't the type of anger like, I'm going to get so angry that I'm going to just hit someone. No, it's that idea of that righteous anger, that anger at sin, that anger at something that shouldn't be there. Ephesians 4:26 says, in your anger, don't sin. Don't let the sun go down on while you're still angry. So it's that idea, that right type of anger. Anger at something that's not pleasing to God. Anger at something that doesn't go along with what God's desire is. That's the type of anger that Jesus is expressing here. So usually we would look and say, there's no way that Jesus could get angry. He's angry when people aren't following God, when people are outright sinning and disrespecting God or the laws that God has given. It starts saying he drove them out from this spot. The spot where they're making that money. He's in that outside court, that Gentile court. He starts driving people out. There's one other time that's recorded in John chapter 2. John chapter 2 records the same, similar event. Not the same one. It's a similar thing. So at least twice, Jesus went in and cleaned the temple out. So you kind of think by now, people would have the idea, hey, maybe we shouldn't be doing this. But this is the second time Jesus is going in, and he starts cleaning the temple. You have those money changers there. Why were they there in the first place? Well, one of the reasons was they had to have a half shekel during the sacrifice. When you're sacrificing, you need to offer this much money too. Well, that's one reason. The other reason, if we've ever traveled outside the country, we've experienced it. When you get to another country, there's an exchange that has to take place. The dollar necessarily isn't going to buy as much as it would here. Or they don't accept the dollar in the first place. You get over into Europe, and you got the euro over there. Well, the dollar's definitely not going to work over there. So you have to exchange your money in. That's what these people were doing, these money changers. Hey, as soon as you get into the city, as soon as you get into the country, come here, and I'll exchange the money for you. Oh, why? Why, you're asking? Because you still need to buy a sacrifice here at the temple, too. So they intertwined each other. Well, I'm going to support this person by saying, well, you have to only use our currency. Well, before you can sacrifice, you got to change with me, but then you can only use the sacrifice he's providing. So it's this network. It's just this evil, wicked, hey, what's the best way we can make money at this point? That's what they're trying to do. They're only focused on the money. It says there are those doves, the doves specifically, those lowliest of low sacrifices. So was it just doves or was it other animals? Could have been a lot of animals, but only the doves right there is the first thing he sees. So you have the money changers. He goes and he throws the tables out. He's sick of this. Stop. Get out. You got to stop doing this. In fact, there's laws that were in place forbidding the temple to be used this way, but the Pharisees didn't care. The Pharisees kind of lacked. They should have been the ones stepping up and say, you cannot do this. But they said, no, we're going to allow it. Why? Well, maybe they were some of the people selling stuff. Their family was some of the people selling stuff. Or they were getting a cut of the profit. They were getting a little extra money to line their pockets. And they were okay with that. When they should have held and said, no, you cannot do this, they said, we're going to allow it because we're getting some kickback from this. We're getting rich from this. So I'm going to allow it. Mark continues into verse 16, and he gives that example of what's taking place during the time in the temple. Once he cleansed the temple, Jesus wasn't even allowing the merchants to go through the temple court. A lot of times, people found the quickest way to get from one part of the city to the other, or even from the outside gate all the way through. It's just quick. Hey, I'm going to do the shortcut. Otherwise, I have to walk almost 5 football fields around, just down one side to get to where I'm going. But I can save a lot of time by just cutting through. So you have the merchants coming into the city, the people coming into the city. I don't want to walk all the way down there, so I'm just going to take the shortcut through. And no one's going to say anything because everyone's doing it. Well, if everyone was jumping off a bridge, no. Has anyone ever used that on their kids? Kids, has anyone ever had that used on them? I said yes. And that kind of ended that conversation for me pretty quickly. So taking this into consideration, I want to understand a couple things. It was not the quietest of places. It was loud and it stank. What I want everyone to do right now is go ahead and close your eyes. Imagine yourself back at this time, about 30 AD. Your place of worship is the temple. And because we're all Gentiles, we can't be in that center court. You have the smell. You have the merchants. The farther in, it gets louder and louder. What are you trying to do right now? You're trying to pray. You have these people shouting. You have these people yelling. You can't focus right now. You can try whatever you want. Would that be distracting to you? If that's what you're smelling, if you go to kneel down and literally right next to where you put your knee, or literally what you put your knee in, you definitely don't want to be putting your knee in. It's that road apple right there. Does anyone have any idea what a road apple is? Okay, just making sure I'm not using a term from Lancaster or Lebanon area. Thanks, Gigi. So you have this stuff. It's not the cleanest of smells. It's not the cleanest of places. It's not the quietest of places either. What in the world is the temple supposed to be used for in the first place? For worship. A place where you can go, focus on God, worship to God, offer those sacrifices that you needed to worship. And yet you're dealing with this sound. You're dealing with these distractions the entire time. Then Jesus starts teaching. Once he drives the people out, he starts teaching with authority, with power, providing support for what he did and why he did it. Isaiah 56, verse 7 says this, "These I will bring to my holy mountains and give them joy in my house of prayer. Their burnt offerings and sacrifices will be accepted on my altar, for my house will be called a house of prayer for all nations," including those foreigners, not just the Jews, the foreigners there. Hey, my house is a house of prayer. Jesus is like, didn't the Bible say, like, this is what it's supposed to be? But in fact, you turned it into this. And we get into Jeremiah 7, verse 11. "Has this house, which bears my name, become a den of robbers to you? But I've been watching," declares the Lord. God's getting ready to come in. He's about to judge people. Hasn't it been said, my house is supposed to be a house of prayer, but you turned it into a den of robbers. You are ripping people off. You are taking their money. You're trying to gain wealth for yourselves, when truly you should be not causing those distractions, not causing that undue stress on someone when they're trying to pray to me. He referenced the prophets from years before, and they're still applicable at that time. You've turned it into this den of robbers. You're only focused so much on yourselves. What can you gain out of this? Your only focus is, how much money can I put in my pocket right now? Mark chapter 11, verses 18 and 19 say this, "The chief priests and the teachers of the law heard this and began looking for a way to kill him, for they feared him. Why? Because the whole crowd was amazed at his teaching. When evening came, Jesus and his disciples went out of the city." So up until this point, they weren't a huge fan of Jesus. Jesus didn't make too many friends between the scribes and the Pharisees. They weren't always too happy with him. Why? Because he kind of said certain things about them they didn't like. "You brood of vipers. Look at those people. They're hypocrites. Whitewashed tombs." That doesn't get people on your side too well. So up until this point, they're angry with him. They're upset. Because what he's saying about them, as well as he's taking their followers away from them. I thought I was the most important one. And now all of them are leaving to follow him. We got to do something. They were that upset that not only did they want to kill Jesus, they wanted to erase his name from all historical records. This wasn't something, well, if we get rid of him, we'll be done with him. No. Why? You could easily make him a martyr for the cause. So we have to do something that powerful to make people realize this is not a person that you need to be following. This is not a person I want you to be going after. I want you to be following what I'm teaching. They were scared of him because all the people followed him. They were scared of him because what he taught wasn't what they taught. In fact, what he taught was what needed to be taught. But that didn't help their cause. They were scared of him. They wanted to kill him, erase his name from all books, erase his name from everyone's memory, so that way, no one ever wanted to hear the name Jesus again. They were scared because, well, if we say the name Jesus, what's going to happen to us? If we follow this guy, what's going to be happening to us? That was the mindset. If I can instill enough fear into these people, they're going to forget about this guy. If I can put that much fear into their minds, they definitely won't want to follow him. And then right there at the end, that long day of ministry, he's tired. Well, I would be too if I just walked that far, start throwing people out, grabbing them by the scruff of the neck and saying, get out of here. Chasing people out of that temple court. He's tired. He heads out to get rest, back to Bethany. Which is something I didn't say before. The place he's probably staying, Mary, Martha, Lazarus, that's their hometown. He's probably staying with them. So he heads back out to where he knows he's going to have friends. He heads back out to where he knows he's going to be safe. Why did he do this? What was the whole point of Jesus trying to get this through the people's minds? Well, you have the fig tree, he cursed it. You have the temple, he cleansed it. What was he doing? There's two things here. First, get rid of the hypocrisy. Get rid of the fake worship in your life. Israel, when you look like this, that's not what I want. I want you not only to look like it, I want you to actually produce like you're supposed to produce. Christians, I don't want you just to look like a Christian. I want you to produce what I want you to produce, those fruits of the Spirit that we talk about. I want you to actually show to others through your actions, yes, I am identifying with Christ. I don't want you just to play the part. I want you to actually be the part. That was the point he's trying to get at. Well, then what about the temple? You all heard it. Could any of you have prayed through all that distraction? Could any of you have truly focused your entire being during that time of loud noises, and even as it got louder, some of you looked up and you were getting uncomfortable. There's people who didn't even close their eyes and they're just looking around like, oh, this is really uncomfortable. Yeah, it's really uncomfortable when we go to worship and we're getting distracted. It's really uncomfortable when we try and focus on God and we're letting those outside distractions come and take over us. When I'm so worried about, who's texting me now? Hey, I got to respond to this email. I got to make this phone call. Oh, hey, I need to add that to the shopping list. Has anyone ever gotten distracted and went to write something else? Wait, no, I can't do that. Happens to me all the time. Why? Because I allow those outside distractions to take my focus off of where it needs to be. I allow those outside distractions to say, hey, these are more important than God right now. When I allow even those outside distractions interrupt someone else. Because the Pharisees, they were allowing it. It was hindering someone else's relationship with God. Am I a distraction to someone else, causing them not to be able to focus on that prayer time where they can worship through song, through reading their Bible? What's causing distraction in your worship? Are you playing the part or are you the real deal? They go hand in hand. Am I playing the part and causing distractions for someone else? Or am I the real deal and getting rid of the distractions in my own life? Maybe it's turning your phone off for X amount of time to pray. Maybe it's just getting out. If anyone drives past during the day and you see me just pacing back and forth up there, just outside, I'm not crazy, I promise. I'm praying. I'm maybe on the phone with someone getting counsel. Just, hey, I need to get a change of view. A couple weeks ago, I came over here and I just started walking around and I started praying. And I'm like, I can't focus. I can't keep my mind on what I need to do. When I stepped away, left my phone over there, left my computer over there, and just started focusing on it, it clicked. I was like, that's what I needed. That's where I want to take this passage. And it's amazing when we remove those distractions from our life, how well God can speak to us, how much we can actually hear God speaking to us. What's distracting you? Is it a job? Is it I get to go play on the boat, on the water, on the quad, I get to go shoot rifles, I get to go play instruments, just go have fun, hang out with friends. If that's causing you to be distracted from truly being able to worship God, maybe we need to rethink this. Because if Jesus took worship and distractions that seriously, I think we need to do the same thing. Not just here, at home, whatever it might be. That prayer closet that we talk about, if it's specifically prayer, maybe it literally is. I'm going to clean a closet out of my house. And when I close the door, I put a do not disturb sign. And it works. Maybe it's, I need to go for a run. I'm not going to take music. I'm just going to go for a run. I've thought of that a few times. I didn't get past the thought, though. But it's finding a way, removing the distractions. Finding a way, I'm the real deal. I'm not playing the part. I'm actually going to live the part out. What's that look like this week for you? What one distraction can you remove from your life for 5 minutes? We're starting small, 5 minutes. What's one distraction you can say, I'm going to just get off internet. I'm going to leave my phone and I'm just going to go walk. I'm going to leave this distraction for 10 minutes to read my Bible. I'm going to specifically spend time this week singing to God. Whatever it might be, what is that one thing that you can remove for 5 minutes so that you can truly worship God? Lord, we come to you now looking and saying, what can we remove? What do we need to remove that's causing us so much?